University of Cambridge International Examinations. International General Certificate of Secondary Education, June Examination Session, 2007. English as a Second Language. Paper 4. Listening Comprehension. Welcome to the exam. In a moment, your teacher is going to give out the question papers. When you get your paper, fill in your center number, candidate number, and name on the front page. Do not talk to anyone during the test. If you would like the tape to be louder, tell your teacher now. The tape will not be stopped while you're doing the test. Teacher, please give out the question papers, and when all the candidates are ready to start the test, please turn the tape back on. Now you are all ready. Here is the test. Look at the questions for part 1. There are 6 questions in this part of the exam. For each question, you will hear the situation described as it is on your exam paper. You will hear each item twice. Part 1. Questions 1 to 6. For questions 1 to 6, you will hear a series of short sentences. Answer each question on the line provided. Your answer should be as brief as possible. You will hear each item twice. Question 1. Natap plays the trumpet and is to tour with his college orchestra. Why must he arrive at the departure point early?
So, we'll be away for 10 nights and we'll play 6 concerts, as well as having full-day rehearsals, so it will be quite tiring for all of you on tour. The coach leaves from the college car park at 6 a.m, but don't forget, you need to be here 30 minutes before that in order to load your instruments safely into the separate trailer. So, we'll be away for 10 nights and we'll play 6 concerts, as well as having full-day rehearsals, so it will be quite tiring for all of you on tour. The coach leaves from the college car park at 6 a.m, but don't forget, you need to be here 30 minutes before that in order to load your instruments safely into the separate trailer.
Question 2. You are travelling to King's Bridge and are in a hurry. Where and when will you find the best train for your journey?
Passenger announcement. The stopping train service to King's Bridge will depart from Platform 9B in 5 minutes' time. Passengers wishing to travel direct to this destination should wait for the express service, which will be arriving on Platform 9A in 12 minutes' time. Passenger announcement. The stopping train service to King's Bridge will depart from Platform 9B in 5 minutes' time. Passengers wishing to travel direct to this destination should wait for the express service, which will be arriving on Platform 9A in 12 minutes' time.
Question 3. Samir is using the washing machine at the laundrette. Which 2 further steps must he take to make the machine work?
Excuse me. Could you help me, please? This machine has a flashing red light when it should be washing my clothes.
Let's see. First, choose your type of wash. You want general wash. And then press the green button. That gives you the red light. The next step is to insert the correct change, £1.50. And finally, press start. If the machine displays a yellow light, press reject and start again. Simple.
Oh dear, I'll try again. Excuse me, could you help me, please? This machine has a flashing red light when it should be washing my clothes.
Let's see. First, choose your type of wash. You want general wash. And then press the green button. That gives you the red light. The next step is to insert the correct change, £1.50, and finally press start. If the machine displays a yellow light, press reject and start again. Simple.
Oh dear, I'll try again.
Question 4. Why should you surf in 2 days' time? Give 2 details.
Shall we go surfing at the beach tomorrow after school finishes?
The weather forecast says only to expect a light breeze. I think it'll be too calm. We'll just have to swim instead.
Well, let's try and go surfing on the day after that. It's the weekend anyway, so we can stay all day. And there's sure to be some wind by then and some enormous waves for us to ride on. Shall we go surfing at the beach tomorrow after school finishes?
The weather forecast says only to expect a light breeze. I think it'll be too calm. We'll just have to swim instead.
Well, let's try and go surfing on the day after that. It's the weekend anyway, so we can stay all day. And there's sure to be some wind by then and some enormous waves for us to ride on.
Question 5. What action does the doctor recommend to help Sanjit's throat? Give 2 details.
Your throat looks very sore, Sanjit. I think you need to rest your voice. No shouting or singing, and go to the chemist and get this medicine at once. Your throat looks very sore, Sanjit. I think you need to rest your voice. No shouting or singing, and go to the chemist and get this medicine at once.
Question 6. Why must Asim's surprise celebration take place in the afternoon?
Let's have a surprise picnic for Asim's birthday tomorrow. I'll bake a cake.
I'll bring crisps and cola and tell the others not to say anything to him about it.
Good. We'll find Asim at lunchtime and go and sit by the river. No, there's a cricket club practice. We'll have to go after school at 4 o'clock instead. Let's have a surprise picnic for Asim's birthday tomorrow. I'll bake a cake.
I'll bring crisps and cola and tell the others not to say anything to him about it.
Good. We'll find Asim at lunchtime and go and sit by the river. No, there's a cricket club practice. We'll have to go after school at 4 o'clock instead.
That is the last question in part one. In a moment, you will hear part two. Now look at the questions for part two, exercise one. Part two. Part 2, Exercise 1, Question 7. Listen to the following interview about chocolate and then complete the details below. You will hear the interview twice.
Good evening and welcome to Food Weekly. Tonight's programme features some new healthy recipes and suggests ways of reducing salt and sugar in our diet. The surprise is that many of these ideas use chocolate as an ingredient. Chris Chang, the leader of the Campaign for Real Chocolate, is in the studio to talk to us. Chris, chocolate is good for our health. True or false?
True, of course. But it does depend on which type of chocolate you buy and use in your cooking.
We'll come back to those details. But first, tell us about your role as leader of the Campaign for Real Chocolate.
I have loved chocolate ever since I was a young child. I grew up in a large family and loved traditional family celebration times, where we might be given gifts of chocolate bars or sweets or chocolate eggs. I'm a dietitian now, and I realised that the chocolate we buy all too often is made from sugar, fat and milk, and is sold as a family chocolate bar. Of course, it just tastes sweet. Nothing like real chocolate should taste.
So you've taken action to promote good chocolate?
Yes. In 2001, I founded the campaign to speak out against chocolate manufacturers who argued that adding fats and sugar in the production of chocolate was acceptable and, of course, cheaper. Actually, chocolate should only be made with cocoa and cocoa butter.
Oh, so how will we know which is the good chocolate when we buy a bar?
Read the back of the packet. Good dark chocolate will contain only 30% sugar, while the lowest quality chocolate contains as much as 80%. Poor quality chocolate will also only have about 5% cocoa on its list of ingredients, whereas the best will have between 50% and 70%.
Why is it important for the makers of chocolate to use cocoa butter in their chocolate and not vegetable fat?
Because cocoa butter is a unique fat. It's what we call a saturated fat, but it behaves like an unsaturated fat, which means it's good for you. It has been shown to reduce blood cholesterol levels.
So good chocolate really is good for our health?
Of course, but only if the chocolate is good quality and made with the correct ingredients. Remember, real chocolate has high percentages of cocoa butter and cocoa, not sugar and vegetable fat. If made correctly, the chocolate also contains a multitude of vitamins and minerals and has antidepressant effects.
You mean it makes us feel happy?
It can certainly make you feel more positive. It also helps to stimulate the brain.
Can you tell the quality of a piece of chocolate by tasting it?
Oh, yes. And so can you. Try these simple steps. The chocolate will smell good. It might remind you of fruit or wood. When you break the chocolate, it should appear reddish in colour. This shows us how much cocoa is in the bar. The redder it looks, the higher the quantity of cocoa used.
Good. Any more tips?
Yes. The chocolate should make a distinct snapping sound when you break it, and it should melt easily. Cocoa butter itself melts at 34 degrees Celsius. Finally, of course, it should taste smooth and delicious.
Lovely. Chris Chang, thank you very much for your advice. We'll all know how to search for and recognise real chocolate now.
Good. Remember that real chocolate is good for you, and enjoy eating it.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Good evening, and welcome to Food Weekly. Tonight's programme features some new healthy recipes and suggests ways of reducing salt and sugar in our diet. The surprise is that many of these ideas use chocolate as an ingredient. Chris Chang, the leader of the Campaign for Real Chocolate, is in the studio to talk to us. Chris, chocolate is good for our health. True or false?
True, of course. but it does depend on which type of chocolate you buy and use in your cooking.
We'll come back to those details. But first, tell us about your role as leader of the campaign for real chocolate.
I have loved chocolate ever since I was a young child. I grew up in a large family and loved traditional family celebration times, where we might be given gifts of chocolate bars or sweets or chocolate eggs. I'm a dietitian now, and I realised that the chocolate we buy all too often is made from sugar, fat and milk, and is sold as a family chocolate bar. Of course, it just tastes sweet. Nothing like real chocolate should taste.
So you've taken action to promote good chocolate?
Yes. In 2001, I founded the campaign to speak out against chocolate manufacturers who argued that adding fats and sugar in the production of chocolate was acceptable, and of course cheaper. Actually, chocolate should only be made with cocoa and cocoa butter.
Oh, so how will we know which is the good chocolate when we buy a bar?
Read the back of the packet. Good dark chocolate will contain only 30% sugar, while the lowest quality chocolate contains as much as 80%. Poor quality chocolate will also only have about 5% cocoa on its list of ingredients, whereas the best will have between 50% and 70%.
Why is it important for the makers of chocolate to use cocoa butter in their chocolate and not vegetable fat?
Because cocoa butter is a unique fat. It's what we call a saturated fat, but it behaves like an unsaturated fat, which means it's good for you. It has been shown to reduce blood cholesterol levels.
So good chocolate really is good for our health?
Of course, but only if the chocolate is good quality and made with the correct ingredients. Remember, real chocolate has high percentages of cocoa butter and cocoa, not sugar and vegetable fat. If made correctly, the chocolate also contains a multitude of vitamins and minerals and has antidepressant effects.
You mean it makes us feel happy?
It can certainly make you feel more positive. It also helps to stimulate the brain.
Can you tell the quality of a piece of chocolate by tasting it?
Oh, yes. And so can you. Try these simple steps. The chocolate will smell good. It might remind you of fruit or wood. When you break the chocolate, it should appear reddish in colour. This shows us how much cocoa is in the bar. The redder it looks, the higher the quantity of cocoa used.
Good. Any more tips?
Yes. The chocolate should make a distinct snapping sound when you break it, and it should melt easily. Cocoa butter itself melts at 34 degrees Celsius. Finally, of course, it should taste smooth and delicious.
Lovely. Chris Chang, thank you very much for your advice. We'll all know how to search for and recognise real chocolate now.
Good. Remember that real chocolate is good for you, and enjoy eating it.
That is the end of Part 2, Exercise 1. In a moment you will hear Part 2, Exercise 2. Now look at the questions for Exercise 2. Part 2, Exercise 2. Question 8. Listen to the following interview about tanzanite, a mineral found in Africa, and then complete the details below. You will hear the interview twice.
Hello, and welcome to our series on Rocks of the World.
Even in ancient times, writers stated that there was always something new to be found in Africa. Here is geologist Bertolt Bach to tell us about the latest find from a mine near Mount Kilimanjaro in Tanzania.
Hello. Yes, the world's biggest lump of tanzanite, so-called because of the country of its origin, Tanzania, has been found 270 metres below ground.
I've never heard of tanzanite.
It's the newest precious stone, and people love its appearance because of its deep blue colour. It's perfect for use in jewellery, for example. Blue gemstones are, after all, rare.
Does it have the same status as a diamond, then, do you think?
Tanzanite is considered fifth in importance after diamond, emerald, ruby and sapphire.
So, is it really new?
Fairly. It was discovered in 1967 by Maasai tribesmen, and its only source is an area of about 13 square kilometres in the mountains in the north of Tanzania. Tanzanite is actually rarer than diamond, so you can imagine the excitement of the Tanzanian miners who uncovered this huge piece of tanzanite.
Mm. How large is it exactly?
It's the size of a building brick and weighs more than 3 kilograms, enough for 30,000 rings or pieces of jewellery.
It must have a huge value.
About $15 million.
So why is tanzanite blue? Is it something to do with the minerals in the soil in the area of the mine?
In its natural state, this precious stone is grey or brown, but it turns blue when heated to 300 degrees Celsius. Originally, the Maasai tribesmen discovered examples scattered over the ground. The rocks had been turned blue by the heat of bushfires, which had been started by lightning. Miners often bring out this blue colour themselves by baking the mineral after first wrapping it in dough.
In dough? Bread dough, do you mean?
Yes, it protects the tanzanite.
So what will happen to the latest huge tanzanite rock?
It's to be displayed in various museums and eventually will be cut up to be sold. Look out for the Mawenzi Tanzanite exhibition in your own country. The mining firm which found the rock has named it Mawenzi after the second highest peak in Tanzania.
Oh, why didn't they name it after the highest mountain in the country?
Because one day a lucky miner might dig up an even larger piece of tanzanite.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Hello, and welcome to our series on Rocks of the World. Even in ancient times, writers stated that there was always something new to be found in Africa. Here is geologist Bertolt Bach to tell us about the latest find from a mine near Mount Kilimanjaro in Tanzania.
Hello, yes. The world's biggest lump of tanzanite, so-called because of the country of its origin, Tanzania, has been found 270 metres below ground.
I've never heard of tanzanite.
It's the newest precious stone, and people love its appearance because of its deep blue colour. It's perfect for use in jewellery, for example. Blue gemstones are, after all, rare.
Does it have the same status as a diamond, then, do you think?
Tanzanite is considered fifth in importance after diamond, emerald, ruby and sapphire.
So, is it really new?
Fairly. It was discovered in 1967 by Maasai tribesmen, and its only source is an area of about 13 square kilometres in the mountains in the north of Tanzania. Tanzanite is actually rarer than diamond, so you can imagine the excitement of the Tanzanian miners who uncovered this huge piece of tanzanite.
Mm. How large is it exactly?
It's the size of a building brick and weighs more than 3 kilograms, enough for 30,000 rings or pieces of jewellery.
It must have a huge value.
About $15 million.
So why is tanzanite blue? Is it something to do with the minerals in the soil in the area of the mine?
In its natural state, this precious stone is grey or brown, but it turns blue when heated to 300 degrees Celsius. Originally, the Maasai tribesmen discovered examples scattered over the ground. The rocks had been turned blue by the heat of bushfires, which had been started by lightning. Miners often bring out this blue colour themselves by baking the mineral after first wrapping it in dough.
In dough? Bread dough, do you mean?
Yes, it protects the tanzanite.
Ah. So what will happen to the latest huge tanzanite rock?
It's to be displayed in various museums and eventually will be cut up to be sold. Look out for the Mawenzi Tanzanite exhibition in your own country. The mining firm which found the rock has named it Mawenzi after the second highest peak in Tanzania.
Oh, why didn't they name it after the highest mountain in the country?
Because one day a lucky miner might dig up an even larger piece of tanzanite.
That is the end of part two. In a moment you will hear part three. Now look at the questions for part three, exercise one. Part 3. Part 3, Exercise 1. Question 9. Listen to the following interview with an astronaut and then answer the questions below. You will hear the interview twice.
Hello and welcome to Science File. Today we are pleased to have astronaut Paul Ryder in the studio. Paul, you've made world history, haven't you?
Yes. I'm known as the astronaut who repaired the space shuttle Discovery while on a spacewalk. I was 223 miles above the Earth at the time, and I performed the first external repairs to a spaceship in orbit from the outside.
I saw you on television. You were in the news headlines.
Yes, I was being watched by a live television audience of millions back on Earth as I carried out the unexpected repairs to our damaged space shuttle. The shuttle was attached to the International Space Station at the time, and our team had been in the middle of carrying out a program of research and experiments in space.
What did you have to do? Were the repairs to the spacecraft very complicated?
Oh, no. I had to extract two pieces of tile, which had been damaged and were hanging loose from the underneath of our spacecraft. If they'd been left in their damaged position, they might have overheated the whole shuttle on re-entry into the Earth's atmosphere.
Did you realise the importance of your spacewalk at the time?
Oh, yes. I knew the implications if I failed, but I tried not to think about that. I concentrated on my mission to repair.
Did you have any help?
My co-pilot helped me from inside the shuttle. He manoeuvred the 50-foot robotic arm, which held me securely in space.
It stopped you from floating away.
It certainly did. I was only outside for 44 minutes, and the actual repair took seconds to carry out. Most of that time was spent getting into the right position underneath the spacecraft. I had to be careful not to touch the spacecraft with my helmet or feet. In fact, the only contact was with my fingers as I extracted the two tiles. One false move, and the delicate tiles which cover the spacecraft could have been damaged. The spaceship is actually rather fragile.
From Earth, on television, you made the repair look easy. Were you due to make a spacewalk anyway?
Yes, we put the repair onto the end of a 6-hour spacewalk. That was to install a new storage container on the space station to which our space shuttle was attached. It was all successful, but I knew that ground control was watching and directing every movement. I couldn't have done it all so effectively without their help.
You weren't alone outside the spacecraft, were you?
My colleague was attached to the outside of the International Space Station in order to watch and encourage me. His words were, "We trained for 4 years, and now you will have to sign autographs for 4 years. You have made space history."
Paul Ryder, the astronaut who made history while repairing Discovery, the space shuttle, while in orbit, give me your autograph. And thank you very much for coming to talk to us.
Now you will hear the interview again.
Hello and welcome to Science File. Today we are pleased to have astronaut Paul Ryder in the studio. Paul, you've made world history, haven't you?
Yes. I'm known as the astronaut who repaired the space shuttle Discovery while on a spacewalk. I was 223 miles above the Earth at the time, and I performed the first external repairs to a spaceship in orbit from the outside.
I saw you on television. You were in the news headlines.
Yes, I was being watched by a live television audience of millions back on Earth as I carried out the unexpected repairs to our damaged space shuttle. The shuttle was attached to the International Space Station at the time, and our team had been in the middle of carrying out a program of research and experiments in space.
What did you have to do? Were the repairs to the spacecraft very complicated?
Oh, no. I had to extract 2 pieces of tile, which had been damaged and were hanging loose from the underneath of our spacecraft. If they'd been left in their damaged position, they might have overheated the whole shuttle on re-entry into the Earth's atmosphere.
Did you realise the importance of your spacewalk at the time?
Oh, yes. I knew the implications if I failed, but I tried not to think about that. I concentrated on my mission to repair.
Did you have any help?
My co-pilot helped me from inside the shuttle. He manoeuvred the 50-foot robotic arm, which held me securely in space.
It stopped you from floating away.
It certainly did. I was only outside for 44 minutes, and the actual repair took seconds to carry out. Most of that time was spent getting into the right position underneath the spacecraft. I had to be careful not to touch the spacecraft with my helmet or feet. In fact, the only contact was with my fingers as I extracted the 2 tiles. One false move, and the delicate tiles which cover the spacecraft could have been damaged. The spaceship is actually rather fragile.
From Earth, on television, you made the repair look easy. Were you due to make a spacewalk anyway?
Yes, we put the repair onto the end of a 6-hour spacewalk. That was to install a new storage container on the space station to which our space shuttle was attached. It was all successful, but I knew that ground control was watching and directing every movement. I couldn't have done it all so effectively without their help.
You weren't alone outside the spacecraft, were you?
My colleague was attached to the outside of the International Space Station in order to watch and encourage me. His words were, "We trained for 4 years, and now you will have to sign autographs for 4 years. You have made space history."
Paul Ryder, the astronaut who made history while repairing Discovery, the space shuttle, while in orbit, give me your autograph. And thank you very much for coming to talk to us.
That is the end of Part 3, Exercise 1. In a moment you will hear Exercise 2. Now look at the questions for Exercise 2. Part 3, Exercise 2, Question 10. Listen to the following talk by a sculptor about his current exhibition, and then answer the questions below. You will hear the talk twice.
I'm Dale, and I'm a sculptor. That is, I make solid shapes and models. My speciality is making sculptures out of coloured glass. You're probably used to eating and drinking from glass tumblers and bowls, but my artworks are not for use in the house. They form exhibitions which delight people all over the world. For years I've been blowing red-hot glass into unusual and artistic shapes. I piece these art forms together into bright and unusual displays. My current project concerns nature, plants, flowers and wildlife, and it forms an exhibition at the world-famous Riverside Gardens. I've been visiting this area since I was very young. Last year, I realized that my glass sculptures would blend beautifully with the natural colors and shapes in the gardens. So I approached the director. He was pleased with my idea. He doubted that anything man-made, like my sculptures, could improve the already beautiful, natural and colorful surroundings. But the display works well. If you walk through the hothouses where the exotic plants are kept, you'll see my glass sculptures. They're not rooted in the earth, growing with the other plants, but you won't notice. Often the sculptures look as natural as the plants, flowers and trees which surround them. In one of the hothouses, for example, I have a group of glass sculptures which resemble oversized flowers. Among the ferns, I've inserted the spiky sticks of my exhibit, which I call green grass. I'm sure you would only notice these grasses after you have gazed for several minutes at the plants nearby. In the cactus area, I placed some red and lilac-coloured reeds. They rise up out of the desert landscape. Nearby, my huge 4-metre-high glass herons, wading birds, dip into water, and yellow glass lily discs float on the pond among the natural water lilies. I even floated some bright pieces of glass sculpture down the river. Local children collected these treasures and piled them all into a small rowing boat. This has stayed on the river for all visitors to see. I have held 200 exhibitions all over the world. It's thought that my garden exhibition is the first of its kind, a breakthrough for art among nature. My aim throughout is to make my work look as if it comes from nature. My sculptures even change with the seasons. The current exhibition runs right through until January of next year, so the regular visitor has plenty of time to appreciate the glass in summer, autumn, and winter, and to see its different aspects as the seasons change. Evening tours are also available, and then the glass is illuminated and appears magical. The best thing is that my sculptures are already part of the natural surroundings in which they've been placed. Plants are beginning to grow themselves around the glass, and spiders weave webs between them, as my whole Gardens of Glass exhibition is now beginning to blend in with the natural environment.
Now you will hear the talk again.
I'm Dale, and I'm a sculptor. That is, I make solid shapes and models. My speciality is making sculptures out of coloured glass. You're probably used to eating and drinking from glass tumblers and bowls, but my artworks are not for use in the house. They form exhibitions which delight people all over the world. For years I've been blowing red-hot glass into unusual and artistic shapes. I piece these art forms together into bright and unusual displays. My current project concerns nature, plants, flowers and wildlife, and it forms an exhibition at the world-famous Riverside Gardens. I've been visiting this area since I was very young. Last year, I realised that my glass sculptures would blend beautifully with the natural colours and shapes in the gardens. So I approached the director. He was pleased with my idea. He doubted that anything man-made, like my sculptures, could improve the already beautiful, natural and colourful surroundings. But the display works well. If you walk through the hothouses where the exotic plants are kept, you'll see my glass sculptures. They're not rooted in the earth, growing with the other plants, but you won't notice. Often the sculptures look as natural as the plants, flowers and trees which surround them. In one of the hothouses, for example, I have a group of glass sculptures which resemble oversized flowers. Among the ferns, I've inserted the spiky sticks of my exhibit which I call green grass. I'm sure you would only notice these grasses after you have gazed for several minutes at the plants nearby. In the cactus area, I placed some red and lilac-coloured reeds. They rise up out of the desert landscape. Nearby, my huge 4-metre-high glass herons, wading birds, dip into water, and yellow glass lily discs float on the pond among the natural water lilies. I even floated some bright pieces of glass sculpture down the river. Local children collected these treasures and piled them all into a small rowing boat. This has stayed on the river for all visitors to see. I have held 200 exhibitions all over the world. It's thought that my garden exhibition is the first of its kind, a breakthrough for art among nature. My aim throughout is to make my work look as if it comes from nature. My sculptures even change with the seasons. The current exhibition runs right through until January of next year, so the regular visitor has plenty of time to appreciate the glass in summer, autumn and winter, and to see its different aspects as the seasons change. Evening tours are also available, and then the glass is illuminated and appears magical. The best thing is that my sculptures are already part of the natural surroundings in which they've been placed. Plants are beginning to grow themselves around the glass, and spiders weave webs between them, as my whole Gardens of Glass exhibition is now beginning to blend in with the natural environment.
That is the end of part 3 and of the test. In a moment, your teacher will stop the tape and collect your papers. Please check that you have written your name, center number and candidate number on the front of your question paper. Remember, you must not talk until all the papers have been collected. Teacher, the tape should now be stopped and all papers collected. Thank you, everyone.